Hello and welcome to a very special members-only episode of Pictorial on Relay FM. So if you are listening to this, thank you so much for supporting Pictorial or whatever Relay FM show that you have chosen to support. In every episode, we tackle something that has to do with art history or culture, and it's a pretty broad-ranging show. So we were thinking, what wouldn't we cover in a normal episode that still is, you know, somewhat related to art? We want to stay within our topic. And then I remember there's a movie called The Da Vinci Code, which is extremely fictional to the extent that we would not cover it on the main show, but it is tangentially about art. So we can cover it here in our very special members-only episode.
I definitely agree on that extremely fictional comment. It's a very good tagline for this movie, actually.
Mm-hmm. So my name is Quinn. If you don't usually listen to the show, hello, welcome. Thank you for joining us on this ride.
And my name is Betty. And if you don't usually listen to this show, I also thank you for joining us in this hopefully interesting review of The Da Vinci Code.
So before we get into any of the plot, let me just say the movie, I wouldn't say it's very good. So we're going to give sort of an overview of what happens in the movie. There will be major spoilers for the whole thing. If you really care about that, I would go watch the movie. But I would recommend you don't really care about that. And that if you haven't seen it or you haven't seen it since 2006, don't worry about it. Just listen to this anyway. It'll still be fun.
I do have to say, actually, so on my second watching of this movie, which was yesterday, this movie isn't actually as bad as I remember it, because I think when I first saw this movie, like, someone told me, oh, if you like, you like art, right? Like, they have like artworks and stuff from the Louvre in here. And I was just like, yeah, sure, I'll watch it. And I was like, this movie is not about art. In fact, it's like a travesty to the art. And then it was just like so long, and I saw it in theaters and I was just like, oh my God. So I think I blocked it out of my mind, because I barely remember anything in this movie. Like, when I was watching it yesterday, I was like, did I see this movie? And then at the end, I'm like, okay, yeah, I remember some of this stuff. But I was like, okay, it's like not good, but there's some stuff that's like, I guess, mildly entertaining. And like, you know, for like a if you're just like, well, this is fictional, so yeah, whatever.
Oh, I found it very entertaining.
Oh, okay, great.
Let me be clear.
Was this your first time seeing it, or had you seen it before?
No, this is my first time seeing it. I'm culturally aware that The Da Vinci Code is a thing. It's a pretty famous book and movie. And I knew about the cryptext with the, you know, the little puzzle tube thing. And I knew it was very controversial, but I didn't really know anything beyond that about like what the movie was actually about. So the basic strokes of this film, it follows our, I guess you can call him a protagonist, Robert Langdon, who is a Harvard University professor who is a specialist in ancient symbols. And he is in Paris for a book signing an event when the French police come up to him, or like effectively the French FBI, and are like, hey, a man has been murdered in the Louvre and he has these symbols on him. So we want you to check him out and see what you can tell us about this very grisly murder that's happened. And he's like, that seems super weird, but okay, fine. But then things really kick off because, you know, we find out that his name was actually written by the man while he was dying. So they think that Robert Langdon was the murderer, even though he doesn't know what's going on. Meanwhile, this other police cryptographer shows up named Sophie. Sophie is the granddaughter of the murdered man. She knows that they think Robert Langdon killed him. She knows that he didn't, and that her grandfather wanted her to come find him so they could solve the puzzle. What's the puzzle? They don't know yet. There's another 2 hours of this film, over the course of which you learn a couple of main things. One, there's a lot of secret societies involved in the Catholic Church is a big thing. There's the Priory of Sion, which are like the Knights of Templar, and they are dedicated to preserving the bloodline of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, who were married, by the way, according to this movie. This is, and there is a vast Catholic conspiracy to cover up this truth because they hate women. That was like a big part of it, is that the actual truth of Christianity and Jesus was like a lot more feminist than Catholicism wants it to be. So that was a big part of it. But there's a living bloodline of Jesus and Mary Magdalene and the Knights of Templar, a secret society that protect them to this day that the grandfather was a part of. That's team one. And team two are the Opus Dei, who are like some weird Catholic cult of assassins, I guess, who are killing the Knights of Templar in order to preserve the secret slash, I guess, maybe try to find the tomb of Mary Magdalene and or the living descendant of Jesus and Mary Magdalene in order to kill them. In order to keep the church's big bad secret safe. There's not a lot of clear motivation as to why, besides just like the overall keeping of power that they have, I guess. And I think that a big part of it is that the Priory of Sion claim that Jesus was mortal, not the actual like God, but he was just like a prophet. So the Catholic Church has a problem with that, as you might imagine. Yeah, so that's what's going on. You sort of find these out in a series of info dumps, which are only mildly better written than what I just told you. These scenes are loosely connected by them running away from the police. At some point, they pick up Ian McKellen, who's like a historian of the Grail. And the other thing is the Holy Grail is Mary Magdalene in this story. They have this whole explanation of this, but okay. The Holy Grail is Mary Magdalene and her womb specifically. Anyway, so he's like a historian of the Grail, and so they pick him up along the way. But oops, he's actually bad, and they have this showdown in Westminster in which our protagonist, Langford, figures out where the tomb of Mary Magdalene is by solving all the puzzles. There's lots of puzzles throughout this. That's why it's called the Da Vinci Code. They're all related to like Da Vinci paintings and stuff. I guess it's supposed to be sort of like a national treasure, like cryptography, solving the clues kind of things, but the clues are very confusing and I don't think really solvable by the audience. Yeah.
It's European national treasure.
Yeah. It's Christian national treasure. Yeah. So they have this giant showdown. This is not the climax of the movie. You think it is. There's another half an hour left. Then they go and find where they think the tomb of Mary Magdalene is, but someone's moved the body. Someone's moved her bones, I guess. Yeah. But there they find out that, oopsie daisies, Sophie is actually the living descendant of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, which somewhere along the way of this 2.5 hours, our two protagonists have accepted this version of the story as fact. It's not clear why, but sure. So she's the descendant of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. They suggest she might have some kind of like magical powers from God. That's again, still not the climax of the movie. Then there's another 10 minutes in which Langford actually figures out where the tomb of Mary Magdalene is. And apparently it's in the Louvre. It's in the basement of the Louvre. That's the movie. There's lots of other people running around and trying to kill each other, but like those are the broad strokes.
Yeah, I think you described it really well as it's just info dumps. Like this whole time while I was watching, I was just like, this movie is just like exposition to the max. Like people just walking around explaining facts that everybody else basically knows. And like the way they introduce is he a priest? He's like the one of the Opus Dei, like.
Yeah, I think he's a monk, technically.
Oh, no, sorry, there's the monk, there's really albino monk, and then there's the priest that's telling him what to do. Like, someone is interviewing the priest, and so they're like, so you're, like, Father so-and-so, and this is what you're doing. And it's like, oh my God. Like, so anyway.
Yeah. And when you set a movie to be about academics, it just lets you just let them talk for 10 minutes to explain to other people what they're studying and what it means for the plot of the movie you're watching. But it's not exactly an engaging way to present information.
No, it's like, it's different when you're reading it in a book as opposed to someone on screen, like explaining the plot to you.
Yeah.
Like, you might as well have had a narrator. Like, that would have been less annoying. But I don't know actually what version you watched, but I accidentally watched the extended version of this movie.
There's an extended version? How yeah. long is it?
So in the end, I think it's not that much longer. It's like, it's 3 hours. So I think maybe the version you watched is just under 3 hours. The version I watched is like 10 minutes, 15 minutes longer or something. Which was just painful.
Oh my god.
So there might have been a couple scenes that I'm gonna mention that you didn't see if you saw the regular theatrical version, but it doesn't add any more to the story, I promise you. So I do want to, before we start our like main review, I do have to get this off my chest, because I think if I don't, people will be yelling at the podcast. So his name is Leonardo, is not Da Vinci. So this book should have been called Leonardo Code if it was trying to be accurate. Leonardo didn't have a last name. He was just known as Leonardo. At the time, it wasn't common for everyone to have a last name, only like aristocracy, noble people did, and a lot of people just had a first name. Leonardo was later like called Leonardo da Vinci in writings because he's from a place called Vinci. So it's like if my last name was lost to history, and in the future, like 500 years from now, I'm Betty from Toronto, and instead of calling me Betty in books, it just says, from Toronto, painted this landscape.
That's really funny.
It's like, no. Like, so that's why like historians and art scholars just say Leonardo. And it's the same with Michelangelo is his first name. Raphael is his first name. Even though those people did have last names, and Rembrandt is his first name, even though he does have a last name. Like a lot of artists, for some reason, are like, even when they have last names, are just known in art history under their first names. So when people use the last name, or in this case, not a last name, it's just like the whole movie, every time they say Da Vinci, I'm just like, oh my God. Like, but I know this is not, like, this is a common thing. Like, Dan Brown is not the only person who makes this mistake. So it's not, like...
of all the sins of this movie...
yeah.
So we're not going to get too much into sort of, like, the religious aspect of it, because that's not what we're here for. But we have to talk about it a little bit, just because it's so wild. So I was doing a little bit of reading. Obviously, this is very controversial for... a number of reasons. One being like sort of the whole theory of Jesus as a mortal man who had children with his wife Mary Magdalene thing is like obviously not the Catholic Church's favorite idea. And then there also was this whole thing about how the two sort of sects that are discussed are the Opus Dei and the Priory of Sion. And the Opus Dei are like a real group. They are controversial, but they're not like this.
Yeah.
Also, they were founded in 1928. Like, they're not, like, they don't have a centuries-long vendetta against the Knights of Templar. And the Priory of Sion is a hoax. This was confusing to read about, but allegedly, this was an organization that was fake, and someone in France, like, created a fictitious background for it, but it was all a hoax the whole time. But Dan Brown believes it is true. Like, Dan Brown is like, in his like nonfiction foreword for the book, he says that the Priory of Sion and all descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate, which is not true.
No.
So that's kind of funny, because when I when the actors were asked about it in the movie, they were like, yeah, it's a movie. It's a, you know, fun, big budget, really silly kind of thing. Like, obviously it's fictional, not true. And Dan Brown's over here being like, it's nonfiction.
It is wild. And I think it is like, I feel like I would feel slightly different about it if Dan Brown was also like, hey, I'm a fictional book writer. I make stuff up. Like, then I can be like, okay, yeah, whatever. Like, you're not yelling at J.K. Rowling for making up Hogwarts because it's fiction. But if J.K. Rowling was like, oh, Hogwarts is real. Magic is real. And you're just like, what? Are you, like, serious?
Yeah. And apparently the real... Okay, wait. The real fake priory that had a different, like, conclusion to their views. They just still had this whole thing about, like, real people being descended from Jesus. But in the movie, it's about feminist theology and that like early Christianity like suppressed the feminist pagan roots of its religion in order to like exert control. Which, listen, I don't know enough about theology to know if like any percentage of this is any bit true at all. But like, I think we can say that the ultimate conclusions drawn from it are probably not, since it is based on what is known to be a fictional organization.
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt that a lot of religion, like including Christianity, is, you know, quite misogynist. Again, I can't comment on whether some early Christians, you know, were less misogynist or maybe, you know, like more feminist than others. It's possible, but anyway, yeah, it's not like this description in the Da Vinci Code is most likely not accurate. So,
and I promise we're going to get to the art in just a minute. Yeah. But one more thing about this topic, because first of all, the way that they talked about this was like pretty gross and gender essentialist and trans exclusionary. But like, this is a movie from 2006 that is supposedly describing a centuries, like a millennia old thing. So like, I'm not surprised, but also it was like it's kind of set my teeth on edge to listen to them talk about stuff like this. But especially in the part where, Ian McKellen tells our scrappy protagonist that like sex was like heterosexual sex, let's be clear, was like how people reached God. Like, oh, yeah. That was how they found God, was by having sex. And I'm like, what are we doing here? What are you talking about? And I mean, for all that is like part of some religions, but it was just so funny like how serious he was about this, and I was like, this is not what I want for my movie.
It's ironic because Ian McKellen's gay. Like,
oh my god, there, it was so heterosexual, and I was like, have you met a gay people can't go to heaven, I guess.
Well, not according to this Ian McKellen. But yeah, actually, that reminds me, I was going to bring this up later, because I guess at one point, Sophie has flashbacks of when she was a teenager, I guess, yeah, going to see her uncle, but like comes across this like cult ceremony, and it's just like his uncle having sex with somebody in the middle of the room and a bunch of people in masks. I guess that's supposed to be the Priory of Scions, like some sort of weird ritual, and I'm just, yeah, like, what? Like, is what? Like,
I mean, sure, but what a choice to include that in the movie, you know? Like,
and again, I haven't read the book, and I don't know if the book is better, but I don't think I'm gonna find out.
Yeah, I was like, my criticisms are not of like any real religion, it's of like the narrative choices made to include these things in a work of fiction. Like, whoa.
Yeah. I might circle back around to the sort of a bit about the religion in a bit when we talk about the art later, about the whole Mary Magdalene in the Last Supper thing. Mm-hmm. But I just have a couple of other like non-art comments. One, for some reason, I was so like in the beginning of the movie, I was just so like WTF. I just wrote in my notes a bunch of question marks when Tom Hanks or Robert Langdon, whatever his name is doing the book signing. Oh, by the way, like, I love how the Louvre's website, when they describe like the Da Vinci Code, puts symbologist in air quotes, because apparently that position does not exist at Harvard. And so he's like a celebrity, and people are like asking him to sign his books, and there's like a long line and a crowd of people around his table. And this police, this French police, just literally comes up to him and puts down a picture of a mangled dead guy on his table while everybody's looking at it. And I'm like, you couldn't have said, excuse me, sir, I need to talk to you in private in the next room or in the hallway. Like, you just plopped down a dead guy. And there was like, I don't know, like, just young people and like people around who might not want to see a picture of a dead guy.
Like, every pacing decision in this movie is very strange. But also, real-time follow-up, if you Google symbologist, some of the first results you get are this movie. And you also get a fake website that Random House made for Harvard symbologist Robert Langdon, which is very cute, actually. I like that they did this.
That's funny. So yeah, the symbologist that, like, who's a celebrity in the Louvre or in Paris. After he sees the picture of the dead guy, they bring him to the Louvre, and so he's walking through the Louvre with the other French cop, and Langdon, I think, points at a camera and says, oh, is this real? And then the cop says, of course not. And they say that, oh, yeah, like, with the Louvre being so big, there's no way they can afford so many cameras because, like, that's so much money. And I'm like, what? What?
Like, the security in this fictional Louvre is not good.
Yeah, so they have this whole entire Louvre. There's one security guard. There's apparently no real cameras. Nobody is monitoring anything, including the dead guy who's just lying there, and all the cops have left. And they can just walk around and examine the dead body without police being around, just, you know, on their own. And then
they practically take the Mona Lisa off the wall.
yeah. Oh, and apparently there's no proximity alarms because they grab a bunch of Leonardo paintings and just remove it from the wall. No alarm goes off. Nobody. And I'm like, dude, like, I, like, at our art gallery, which is probably 1/100th the budget of the Louvre or less, we have cameras everywhere. And, like, we're pretty big too. Again, not as big as the Louvre in terms of geography, but, like, it's still pretty huge. It's got lots of floors, and, like, we have cameras, we have hundreds of security guards, we have proximity and infrared alarms everywhere. And, like, one time I was, like, within 4 feet of our most prized painting in the AGO, which is, again, like, a tiny fraction of a percentage the cost of the Mona Lisa, like, the alarm went off, and the security, like, we have a trap door that, like, shuts off if you try to touch that, like, painting.
You have a trap door?
Well, it's like, it's not, it doesn't come down and, like, slice you. It's just like, it's like a fire door, except it's like, when you trip the alarm of, if somebody thinks you're gonna harm or try to steal that really expensive painting, it will, like, I'm not sure I'm supposed to be sharing this, but whatever. But, and the door just comes across and locks you into that one room. So anyway, and, like, the Louvre has, like, thousands of security guards. It costs so much more to pay, like, a security guard for a year's salary than buying a camera that might be, like, $500. And maybe he was joking. That's all I can think. Maybe he was just pulling Robert Langdon's leg, like, I guess. But I was like, but so many people probably believed it. And I'm like, anyway, the cameras at the Louvre are real. Don't try to steal a painting because you're going to get caught.
Oh my gosh. There's an extended section of this movie that takes place in the Louvre, in which, you know, the dead body is discovered, and they're first examining the body, and then they're examining a bunch of paintings at which there are secret messages written. I'm really unclear as to when these secret messages were left there.
I'm like, this guy must have died over a 4-hour period if he wrote all of these messages all over his body and on the floor and the walls in, like, 40 different spots in the Louvre.
Maybe, all I can think is, so he was the fourth person to be murdered. There were, like, four of these, you know.
Okay, right.
Priory of Sion dudes. And I think he was the fourth one to be killed. So maybe he left the other messages like the day before because he knew it was coming.
Yeah, it's possible. And of course, yeah, in the beginning when the police was trying to figure out who the killer is, and of course they think it's Robert Langdon because that name was written by the dead guy, I'm like, you know, if he had all this time to write all these messages, why couldn't he have just wrote, creepy albino monk killed me? That would have been significantly easier than leaving 100 clues all around this art gallery. So the one scene that I don't know if you saw is, so after they went to, I think it's the Virgin of the Rocks, which they call Madonna of the Rocks in the movie. I don't know, maybe that painting has multiple names. Anyway, they like take it off the wall because there's the fleur-de-lis like cross thing that was hidden there that they later use as a key. Anyway, so a security guard actually comes in while they were trying to leave after they took the Madonna off the wall. And the security guard's like, freeze. And then they hide behind the painting. Both of them are using the painting as a shield. And then Sophie pulls out like the knife and says, if you come closer, I'll like cut the painting. And of course, immediately I'm like, Sophie, you're a dead woman. Like, do not harm the painting. There's only like 19 other Leonardos in the entire world. And then,
oh my God.
She's like, I'm gonna destroy the painting. And of course the security guard then like puts down the gun and they like run out or something. And I'm just like, oh my God, like I cannot believe this is a part of the movie.
Oh my God, that's so funny. Yeah, that was not in the version that I saw.
Yeah, it's not a great scene, but I was just like, oh my God, she's like holding a painting hostage.
Well, so while I don't necessarily recommend watching this movie if you don't want to, I do recommend going and reading the official Louvre tour guide to the works of art that are discussed in this movie. It'll be linked in the show notes because, boy, is it funny. It's very it's informative. It's really interesting, and obviously we're going to talk about it, but also whoever wrote this was pretty salty about the movie and uses phrases like, this powerful literary effect is a travesty of art history. And also in the middle, like, diverges to dunk on Freud, which always valid, and then says, yeah. Freud, who dared to discern in it motifs hidden from ordinary mortals. Like, the level of sarcasm, oh, highly recommend reading this whole thing.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this person's writing. Yeah, and I think in the beginning when they were introducing the sort of tour of Da Vinci Code pieces, said that, you know, this is like a minor thing, but like some of the artworks that were said to be in a certain place is actually not in this location, which I think is a minor issue. But they wrote, the author of the Da Vinci Code has, as often in his book, altered the real topography for the purpose of his narrative. Yeah, it is pretty funny. And I did like the one part, I think they were describing the Virgin of the Rocks, so the one that Sophie tried to slash with the knife. She actually had the knife, like I think it touched the painting, and I was like, ah! So anyway, I'm sure they used like a replica in them filming, obviously. So according to Dan Brown, that it suggests that Mary, like Jesus' mom Mary, is holding an invisible head in her left hand, and the invisible head is supposed to symbolize Mary Magdalene, and her neck is being symbolically sliced by the gesture of the archangel Uriel on the right. So Leonardo was supposedly showing the church's conspiracy against Christ's companion. And so they wrote, this far-fetched interpretation of the painting might have been inspired by the work of Bernardino Luini just to the left, Salome receiving the head of St. John the Baptist, which is in like an actual, in the Bible, I believe. I haven't read the Bible recently.
It's like a well-known story in the Bible when it's like commonly depicted in art.
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, but so they wrote, in reality, Mary's mysterious gesture relates to the traditional religious iconography. Mary is the mother of Jesus, but she is also the incarnation of the church, the house. In the painting, therefore, she seems to be covering the head of her son with her left hand as if a roof. And so this is, and then this goes into the line where they say, the Da Vinci Code thus transformed a gesture of protection into a metaphorical representation of murder, and this powerful literary effect is a travesty of art history. Oh, it's great.
This is the point at which whoever was writing this article seemed to get really mad at Dan Brown. A less offensive embellishment that he made, apparently, was with the rose line, which I thought this was really interesting. So in the movie, there are these rose medallions that are interpreted as symbols of Mary Magdalene, because I guess roses are the symbol of Mary Magdalene, and they form a north, they are in Paris, these are real things, they're actually called the Arago medallions, there's 135 of them, and they form a north-south line in the city that is actually on the exact path of the former meridian of Paris. They're commemorating that old meridian, which has been redefined into the Greenwich Meridian in 1884. But there are actually a contemporary art piece. They were put there in 1995 by Dutch artist Jan Dibbets. So they have nothing to do with the Knights Templar. but they're actually pretty cool. And there are actually some... They're embedded in, like, different parts of the ground and in buildings, and, you know, they are, like, around the Louvre. So there are actually 15 of them in and around the museum, which they specify in this article. So that is, like, a really cool piece of art. It has, well, you know, assuming that the conspiracy theory put forth in Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code is not accurate, they don't have anything to do with the Catholic Church, but they are pretty.
For sure, yeah. Yeah, kind of speaking of the streets of Paris, one other thing that I just was, like, laughing about and put lots of question marks in notes was after they escape from the Louvre, they're, like, driving around. This is the running around part, in this case, driving around. At one point, Sophie sees, like, the police, and she's just like, okay, I'm booking it. And she drives backwards with her, like, mini for, like, 10 minutes like around these cars in like these narrow French streets, and I'm like, is she like, didn't she say she's a cryptologist? Is she French James Bond? Like, what is, or like Jason Bourne or something? What is going on? Like, and she just like narrowly misses these like trucks and then the police like crash. Like, I thought I was watching some Jason Bourne movie for a second, and I was just like, okay, maybe she's secretly like a secret agent. That's what they're gonna reveal, I guess.
Yeah, there's a bunch of points where they show her being like really good at driving or hand-to-hand combat or something like that, which I guess is supposed to be like she received training from her grandfather growing up. But they were estranged from the time that she was like, she went to like boarding school at, like, age 12 or 13 or something, and then they were estranged for like the rest of her life pretty much. So I don't know why she'd be really good at driving.
Yeah, like driving and like this like ninja stuff. So, but maybe the training she had prior to 12 was like stuck with her, but yeah, it was just really strange. But you know, I guess, yeah, entertaining nonetheless, but just like kind of out of place.
Another big thing with the actual sort of objects in the Louvre are the whole segment of this movie about the inverted pyramid. So if you're not familiar with it, the actual sort of architecture of the Louvre is there's sort of this giant glass pyramid that juts out into the street, and then if you look down into it, that's the Louvre. There's a big plaza that surrounds the pyramid. It's sort of a very iconic thing of Paris. And then inside the Louvre, there is the inverted pyramid. And so there's an upside down pyramid inside the Louvre, and that the sort of point of that is just a few inches above the point of a really small little pyramid. And they comment on this like a few times throughout the film. And at the end of the movie, Langdon has this realization that the rose line is leading apparently to the tomb of Mary Magdalene, which is in the Louvre, and it's underneath that little pyramid. But when I was reading about this, first of all, the Louvre was like, no. But then I found another source that apparently not only is there not anything underneath that pyramid, it can actually be easily moved aside for cleaning.
Oh, yeah, that's so funny.
So it's like regularly moved if they need to clean the floors.
That's awesome. Yeah, honestly, I half expected him to start digging, like, and I was like, it's like, oh, hey, Mary. But I mean, the other thing that's kind of, yeah, that's kind of weird about that, and I'm still kind of confused, is so like that little passage that they get out of the codex was, is that what it's called? A codex?
Cryptex.
Oh, cryptex. Right. Cryptex is like the poem that's supposed to like a map to the tomb of Mary Magdalene. But the problem is that that glass pyramid was built in 1989. So like the cryptex must have only been 10 years old, or maybe it predicted that in the future there's going to be a glass pyramid, unless there was some other pyramid similarly there previously that they just replaced with glass. I don't know, but it's a little weird that some super old cryptex has a prediction of what's going to be there in 2006 or 2003, whatever this movie is supposed to set.
Well, didn't that, so the cryptex led to the other place though, right? There's like a different church that, right, like where they used to have Mary Magdalene's bones, and then Langdon, with his super good intuition skills, then realized that recently they had moved Magdalene into the Louvre.
Oh, okay. That makes a little bit more sense.
It doesn't, though, because how did they get her there? How did they get her in there?
Like, yeah, a little bit more sense, but not really.
It's because they have no cameras.
Yeah. Oh, yes. And no guards. And, like, nobody watching the Mona Lisa. You can just look behind her and find the written secret message. Yeah. So there's also, I think in one part, like, I can't remember who it was, if it was Langdon or the cop, or maybe they were talking, and they say, oh, there's 666 panes in the pyramid, which is, like, the number of the beast, but there's actually apparently either 673 panes or 689 panes, depending on who you ask. They ended up consulting a partner at I.M. Pei's architecture office to like confirm on the drawings or something if how many glasses there are, but there's more than 666. It's like, it's not the number of the beast, so that's fictional.
Yeah, definitely. I do find it funny that they are not 100% sure of the exact number. I mean, I guess since they aren't exactly sure, it could be 666, but all of the estimates that people believe it is are more than that, so we're pretty sure.
Yeah, I guess maybe it depends on how you're counting the triangles. Like, I don't know if they're counting a triangle within a triangle. Like there's a whole mathematical formula on the Wikipedia page of the Louvre Pyramid that I'm not bothering to read right now, but anyway, I guess there's disagreement of what counts as a triangle. That's why there's like these different numbers.
So sort of a pivotal point in this movie, a point in which Ian McKellen does talk at us for about 10 minutes, but a pivotal point of this movie is using the painting of Leonardo's The Last Supper in order to provide evidence of this, we'll call it a theory, that Jesus was a mortal man who was married to Mary Magdalene and she was pregnant with his child at the time of his crucifixion. And apparently there's like other evidence that they use in the movie for this, but a huge part in sort of illustrating this is by using this painting, which I found to be a very interesting device.
Yeah. And so obviously, yeah, if you read, whether it's the Louvre's explanation or other articles about The Last Supper, like there's a tremendous amount of art history research into this painting because it's very well known. So at the time when Leonardo painted The Last Supper, he would have had to refer to previous versions of The Last Supper, and there were like a lot of rules he had to follow, like, you know, where people sit, like if they would have a beard or a silver pouch in their hand, like things like that, to identify who this disciple is supposed to be, so that we don't have to guess. And so if you look at previous Renaissance or even early Renaissance and Gothic paintings of the Last Supper, they're depicted very similarly. And Saint John is always painted as a very effeminate looking man. So like with long hair, with like no beard. Like if you look at like references that Leonardo would have referred to, like John is quite often looks like a girl. So I mean, I guess Dan Brown could use that as more evidence towards the fact that there's a woman in the Last Supper. Like, you know, it's in every painting, but it's like, no, that's John. And I don't think there's a single like reputable scholar of like paint art and religious history that would say that it's not John. So you know, the whole thing about it being Mary is again, it's that part is definitely fictional.
A big thing here as well is that Leonardo would have had no reason to want to disguise Mary Magdalene as a male disciple in this. Like other painters did depict her at the Last Supper, and it would have been like fine to show Mary Magdalene being there. So this idea that it was like this hidden in plain sight kind of thing, like, doesn't hold up at all either.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in fact, yeah, Mary Magdalene was there. She just isn't often depicted in the Last Supper's painting because it usually has his 12 disciples. And I watched a YouTube video, which I think we should link because it's really funny. It's like it's a scholar or art historian of like Leonardo's works. And he just says, oh, it's so stupid. He says, yeah, it's really stupid because it's like, it would have been like, not just controversial, like it would be so, such a no-no for Leonardo to like, to question the Catholic Church like this. And I don't think his intention was ever to like, you know, because these are his patrons, they pay him. Like, why would he try to offend them? So
also the fact that the evidence that Ian McKellen gives in this scene, he's like, look at this person, don't they look like a girl? And they're like, wow, I never realized how much like a girl this person looks. And he's like, the mind sees what it wants to see. And I'm like, what?
And it's like, it does. And he's like, you look, it's a V between Mary and Jesus. And it's like, oh my God, like you're going to see letters everywhere in every painting. If any like diagonal, you see a V, that's just like, oh, this is a J for Jesus. This is C for conspiracy. Like, you're just going to see that everywhere. And then anyway, it's again, like if Dan Brown was like, this is fiction, it's like, yeah, whatever. Sure. But he's like, everything about art and architecture and historic is all real. It's like,
yeah, I mean, I didn't do too deep research into what Dan Brown thinks of this is real and isn't real. Clearly more than I do. But I don't want to totally like slander him because who knows. But yeah, it's funny that he is presenting any amount of this as nonfiction.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just weird. Right after the Last Supper, when they were like escaping from the police again, more running. There's a lot of funny things that happen when they're running too, is that why I still don't understand why they took the monk. Like, did they think he was gonna be helpful? Because I was like, didn't he just try to kill you? Why couldn't you have just tie him up and leave him to the police to be arrested?
Nope. Betty, don't you forget that Ian McKellen wants to kill him, and they say, no, he could be useful. And then that's the end of it.
Oh, okay.
Unclear. I mean, I guess hypothetically he could be. He's not, but he could be.
Yeah, I'm just like, I mean, it just sets him up to like, you know, later on, because you realize that like Ian McKellen's the bad guy. So he was just trying to deceive everyone. And it's like, okay, but like, this is just totally like, why is this guy here? So, but
oh my gosh. Also about the assassin monk, there were so many sort of countries and the whole Catholic Church and like different organizations within the Catholic Church called for boycotts of the movie or greater education and blah blah blah. But and then there's this one little note that's like, The National Organization for Albinism and Hypopigmentation expressed concern about Silas's character giving people with albinism a bad name. However, the filmmakers did not change his appearance. And just this one little note, like, made me really sad, because I'm like, yeah, this is the second piece of media this month that I've watched that's depicted albinos as serial killers. Oh. And it's a weird pattern and is kind of mean to people with albinism. Like, what the hell?
Yeah, that's true. That's quite offensive. And yeah, that monk is creepy. Like, yeah. I think the only reason I'm like, I remember watching this movie, like, literally the only scenes I can remember is like the monk, like, self-flagellating. And I was just like, okay, like, yeah. Like, fast forward. Like,
the monk is Paul Bettany, by the way, for anyone who cares about Paul Bettany. And he's the acting in this film, like, is actually pretty good. I mean, like, the cast is stellar, obviously. And especially, I think Paul Bettany does, like, a great job with that character, but he is deeply disturbing.
Yeah, that's for sure. The other part that I think you might have mentioned to me earlier is when they solve the cryptex.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll explain the setup for this, which is, there's something about an orb, honestly. Okay, so there's lots of different puzzles throughout this, because, you know, Langdon's very smart, and that's the only character trait he has. He's smart and claustrophobic, and we know literally nothing else about this man. Yeah. But anyways, there's lots of little puzzles that he has to solve throughout the story, and one of them is about an orb that's missing from Isaac Newton's tomb. Or like his burial place, and that is going to be the answer to the cryptex, which inside of it has the map to the tomb of Mary Magdalene. So this is all very important and high stakes. So he goes over and stands by the tomb for a while, and lots of words and letters fly around his head in very sort of movie fashion. And then,
well, later it's revealed that even though Robert Langdon says, oh, sorry, I can't figure it out, and then throws the cryptex onto the ground, thus, like, destroying it because the vinegar leaks and destroys the map, tricking Ian McKellen into thinking that he couldn't figure it out. But, of course, he figures it out, and it's Apple.
The orb was in Apple.
I don't think anyone in the universe has ever... Like, if it's like, what is this apple shaped like? I don't think anyone said an orb. Like,
yeah, they definitely only use the word orb because it sounds sort of older and more mysterious and theological than sphere, I guess, would be the more layman's term for orb. But yeah, it's very funny.
You could say, like, an apple is spherical-esque, like, shaped with, like, you know, distortions, but like I feel like whenever I picture of an orb, like, I think of, like, it should be glowing or translucent or glass, but, like,
yes, it's got to glow if it's an orb.
Yeah this, an apple is, anyway, whatever. So like, that's how he solves the cryptex.
This isn't that important, but this is the point in which I kind of give up with my notes. This is 2 hours in, and what I thought was the end of the movie before I realized there was 30 minutes left. But here I wrote, but he didn't destroy the cryptex. He solved it. The code was Apple because of Newton. This movie is stupid.
Yeah, I love it. I think for you, there might have been like half an hour left. For my version, there was 50 minutes left. And I was just like, what? Like, what else is there? Like, how much more can there be? Like, you've solved the puzzle, you're done. And it just went on, and I was like, okay, well, you know, that's fine. But like, I think this was also, when I saw it the first time too, I was just like, okay, this movie is not about art. Like, I'm sitting through, they supposedly find some lost Leonardos in that church that they find the missing Mary Magdalene body. But anyway, you know, obviously that's fictional. I mean, there could be, but we don't know, unless Dan Brown knows something we don't.
This entire movie just really reminded me of that ad for the movie The Snowman, which was some horror movie, I guess, where it just says, Mr. Police, you could have saved her. I gave you all the clues. And it's just such a dumb ad, and it became a meme. And literally, like, every time they're doing some kind of very convoluted millennia old puzzle, allegedly. All I could think was, I gave you all the clues.
Yeah, how could you not have figured this out? Well, and then the only other thing, like, related to the whole Mary Magdalene thing that I still don't understand is they, like, even if they found the tomb and found Mary Magdalene's bones and then did the DNA testing and found out that Sophie was related to her, one, how do you prove those bones are Mary Magdalene's? Like, it could have just been any, like, really old 2,000-year-old dead woman. Yeah, it could Sophie be related to a dead woman from 2,000 years ago? Anybody could.
Probably. Yeah, I would expect so, yeah.
Yeah, and then it's like, okay, even if somehow you prove those bones are Mary Magdalene, I don't know how do you prove that it was Jesus she had sex with? Like, do you have Jesus's bones? Like, I'm so confused.
I thought the same thing. I was like, wait, but how are they going to prove the Jesus part, though? That seems like the more controversial part. Yeah, who knows? I understand why people in the Catholic Church didn't like it. But also, I mean, it's a movie. It's not even a very good movie.
Yeah, I mean, again, like, I don't have a problem, you know, with people fictionalizing, you know, religious texts, because I'm not religious and, you know, I don't think it's sacred or anything. Again, if it's fictional, yeah, whatever. But yeah, I can definitely understand why some people might be upset.
Yeah, I'm not particularly religious, so obviously I wasn't really bothered by sort of the wild speculations put forward, especially because they are so, like, just in terms of actual historical fact and what historians know about, like, the people of that time and actual historical creation of the Catholic Church are easily disproven. So that's, like, yeah, this is not true. I would be very interested to know how many people have their views of, especially Mary Magdalene as a religious figure, influenced by this movie, though.
Yeah, I think it is. I'm sure some people may have taken this movie at face value. And again, it's like, funnily, it's like, to me, the things that, like, made me, like, annoyed wasn't so much, like, the wild extrapolation and of religious interpretation of, like, these religious historical facts. It was more like, I'm like, the Louvre has cameras and his name's Leonardo and you should have set off an alarm. Like, it's more so about the artwork and the historical accuracy of, like, the actual paintings and the artists. Like, I care more about that. I'm like, I hope people don't, like, actually think that Leonardo was hiding secret messages. I hope they don't actually think that Mona Lisa is supposed to be kind of a man. Like, it's just like, no, like, Leonardo was known to paint very effeminate figures. Like, he did that a lot. And, you know, like, it's not necessarily meaningful in the way that you think. So that's more so what I want to, like, dispel the myths about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think kind of a fun way to wrap this up is quoting what the Louvre wrote about the Mona Lisa as interpreted by the Da Vinci Code. Because as they say, every day, thousands of visitors come to the Louvre to see Mona Lisa in the flesh and try to penetrate her disturbing mystery. Ever since the work was painted in 1504 by Leonardo da Vinci, kings and artists, historians and tourists, poets and thieves have projected their fantasies onto her. All sorts of things have, are, and will be said about her. The Da Vinci Code, by attributing to her anagrams, oddities of composition, and knowing smiles, merely restates it in its own way, all of the myths attached to it. I thought that was, like, a really nice way to talk about that, because with the Mona Lisa, which is arguably the most famous painting in the entire world, obviously the Da Vinci Code has its own wild explanation as to things about the painting, but so do so many other things and so many other sort of projected ideas onto what she is. And I like the way that they don't even take the time to sort of dispel those myths one at a time the way they do with the other art pieces. They're like, at this time, they're like, sometimes art is mysterious and sometimes people do project their own ideas onto that and people are always going to do that and sometimes that's okay. And I thought that was kind of a nice thing that they did in their own little poetic way.
Yeah, I think at this point, this was towards the end of the article, the writer had ripped apart enough Dan Brown facts, in quotations, I'm doing air quotes, that they're just like, yeah, the Mona Lisa, people make up stuff about her all the time. You know, like Dan Brown, but that's cool.
You know, sometimes you make your own interpretations, and that's okay. So for those of you who are supporting, again, thank you so much. It really means a lot to us, and I hope you enjoyed this very special episode. If this is the first time you're hearing from us, we have other episodes that are a bit more serious and less about making fun of Dan Brown, but they're also about art history and art museums, and we have fun over on our main show feed as well. So check us out there at relay.fm/pictorial. I'll see you later.